the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning I speak with Dr. Caroline Fleck, who shares the single most important social skill we have, which is the key to conflict resolution, building intimacy, and even true love. Then Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with Drs. John Elliott and Jim Gwynn, who tell us that the average American worker spends 156 hours a year engaged in moderate to intense workplace conflict, and they'll tell us how to get along with anyone. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My next guest, Dr. Caroline Fleck, will tell you that validation may be the single most important social skill that we have. But what is validation? Giving validation is communicating acceptance and belonging to others. What validating others is not, necessarily, giving approval, praising, and agreeing with them. Well, joining us now to tell us more is Stanford professor and dialectical behavior therapy practitioner, Dr. Caroline Fleck. She'll talk to us about her new book, Validation, how the skill set that revolutionized psychology will transform your relationships, increase your influence, and change your life. Caroline Fleck, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I wonder if every time you bring up this word validation, people think they know what it means, but they don't really know what it means.
Oh, yeah. Every time. I mean,
what is it?
Yeah. So you did a nice job there in your description. So it is communicating acceptance. So when we feel validated, we feel seen, we feel heard. Now, the academic definition is a little bit more complicated. We say that it communicates mindfulness, understanding, and empathy such that another person feels accepted. All right. But at the end of the day, it's just showing that you're there, you get it, and you care. And the result, the effect it has, is that the other person feels accepted, not judged, which is the case with praise. Okay, so praise says, I like the way you look. I like the way you perform. It's a thumbs up emoji on an Instagram photo, right? It's a positive judgment, but it is a judgment nonetheless. That is fundamentally different from acceptance and validation, which says, I accept you as you are, independent of how you look or perform.
Okay, validation. There we go. Now, you are a dialectical behavior therapy practitioner.
That's right.
So I know about cognitive behavior therapy, but could you explain what that is, what dialectical behavior therapy is, and how it differs from cognitive behavior therapy?
Sure. So cognitive behavior therapy and behavior therapy in general, these are approaches that are very focused on change, typically changing behavior in the context of behavior therapy, and then changing thoughts or maladaptive, distorted ways of interpreting information. That's cognitive behavior therapy. Okay. So change is the name of the game there. Dialectical behavior therapy, which came on the scene in the 90s, was actually a huge deal that few outside of the field really kind of appreciate what it did in terms of advancing our understanding of psychology. Dialectical behavior therapy places equal emphasis on acceptance, communicating acceptance, and fostering change. Because up until DBT, we had a whole bunch of folks who were struggling to change, who were resistant to change, that we couldn't really treat using just these standard modalities. And it wasn't until we started to incorporate a corresponding emphasis on acceptance that we began to be able to treat conditions we hadn't previously been able to. So the message in DBT, and I love this, it's I'm doing the best I can and I need to do better. Okay, so you can hear just kind of in that motto, in that mantra, the acceptance and change messaging. And that's really what dialectical behavior therapy brought to the scene.
So as a therapist then, when you're meeting with a client, a patient, is it that you accept so that ultimately they end up changing?
I mean, big picture, on some level, yes. And I can't emphasize this enough. When I am validating someone, I don't really have, it's kind of like almost a mindfulness exercise wherein the other person is the focus of my attention rather than like the breath or something external. And I'm really just trying to have them feel seen. And I am challenging myself. Part of the practice is an internal one. I am looking for the kernel of truth. And so sure, maybe I have some change agenda that I'm hoping for down the road, but I'm really not indexed on it in the moment. And yet time and time again, what you will find is once that validation has landed, it is so much easier to pivot towards, okay, now what can we do? Yes, this situation sucks. Oh my God, you're devastated. I would be devastated too. Oh, and I'm not doing any of this kind of in a fake way, but like I need to genuinely be able to get into that space. I get it. This is more than it seems like one person can handle. I get it. Once there's that, then we can maybe pivot and working on how to problem solve or fix what's going on here.
Right. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Dr. Caroline Fleck. She's a Stanford professor, and she is a practitioner of dialectical behavior therapy, but she's talking to us today about validation. It's her new book. It's this whole skill set. It's practicing acceptance and empathy without necessarily agreeing. I'm trying to think of, there are a million current examples.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We could talk about, and because I think it's on everyone's minds now. You know, you could take the topic of talking to someone who disagrees with you about tariffs, and we can do that. And maybe we'll get into that. But I also think, since we were talking about my co-host who's off visiting a college today with son, say, for example, now's the time that kids who are graduating seniors are deciding where they're going to go to school. And your child comes to you and said, you know what? I got into all these schools. And what I really decided I'm going to do is take a gap year. And I'm going to go to New Zealand and go trekking for the year. Okay. Using validation. I mean, in your head, you're saying, if you're a parent who's like, no, you need to get right into college because I don't trust that you'll ever come back and go to college in New Zealand trekking for a year or whatever it is. Give us this example.
Yeah. So as a parent, so the first thing I'm noticing, if I'm kind of in the playing the role of the parent here, is the, oh no, oh crap, make this stop response that I'm having internally. Like that is my parent radar going off. And it's saying, jump in, intervene, do something to get this train back on the tracks, okay? To me, that is like a little like bell, like one of those like mindfulness bells that kind of rings. And I'm like, okay, I need to be careful here. Those emotions tell me that I need to reorient. Because if I just act in accordance with those emotions, I'm not gonna be effective. I might be right. I might be right that that's probably not the, you know, best use of their X, Y, or Z. I may not be, but let's say that I am. It doesn't matter if I'm not effective, all right? So in that moment, I need to pivot off of what I think, and I need to try and get into their headspace. And I can actually do that pretty easily once I kind of calm it down. So what I'd be thinking with that kid is, first and foremost, whoa, that is a big pivot. That's a big pivot. And I'm guessing you know that we were looking forward to you going to college. So that must have taken some courage to bring this up. I'm impressed. Can you tell me a little bit more about like what you're thinking? Because it sounds exciting. I've never been to New Zealand. Was that the example you used, New Zealand? Oh, God. Right. So I immediately pivoted and did not probably give them what they were expecting, which was, you know, a speech and a lecture. Yeah. And instead, I tried to join them in that emotion, okay? And in that thought process and in that experience. I'm sure they did feel nervous coming to me. That's not inauthentic if I am to say that, right? I'm just focusing on something other than what I want to change in that moment.
Right. And yet, that child is thinking, wow, this is going really well. My mom is going to be okay with me not going to college. Wow, this is, going along thinking, okay, because you are validating what that child is feeling, but where does
Yeah, I can hear it. Where does the change come in? This is gonna get, we're gonna lose it.
exactly right, because it kind of feels like green light, green light, green light, and then it's going to be red light.
Well, so here's the thing. One, I am always open to being influenced. All right. And let me tell you, I have worked with folks who have some pretty significant problems. And I am open to someone who says, I think I can get sober on my own after 10 years of drug use, right? So I'm not sitting here as the truth holder, and I take that very seriously. But more importantly, I'm going to share this little piece of advice that I was given in my training to become a DBT therapist. I use it every day. It has been so transformative for me. And that is, I ask myself in any given moment, I can respond with problem solving, trying to change, or I can respond with validation. But I cannot do both. So I have to choose one. In this moment, I chose validation. Okay. That doesn't mean I can't pivot to problem solving down the line. There's nothing that says I have to keep nodding yes and validate something I don't think is valid. So if they give me their thought process and that doesn't seem valid, I don't see validity in that. I can focus on the emotions. It makes sense that you feel this way. The desire to go, that makes sense. And I can say, I think we're missing some facts here. I wonder about this piece. Okay. So where we get confused, where we screw up, is that we're focused on what we disagree with and we at the exclusion of everything else. And the truth is, you can totally, I imagine, relate to how they're feeling, to the desire to escape after having been in high school for however long and just want to, you can see validity in all of that. What I'm saying is to be effective, open with what you see validity in, open with what you understand and can relate to. In so doing, you will establish connection. That connection then makes it much more easier, constructive, and collaborative to look at the pieces that are not as valid, in that they're not logical, they're not effective, or what have you.
You have been a therapist for most of your life.
Yeah, a very
Even
long
before you
time.
were, even before you were a therapist, you were a therapist. And we all have that friend. I've got one. I can think of her right now. How I always find myself opening up to her. And you were always that person.
I was.
Were you always practicing validation?
So what I realize now in retrospect is I do think I had kind of a natural inclination toward it, but I wasn't always, I'd say I'd get there maybe 40% of the time, maybe 50, which sounds pretty low, but I think on average, folks respond with validation about 10% of the time. All right. When people come to us with issues, 90% of the time we give solutions and problem solving. All right. And so I was batting, at a higher average than that, but I was still only at about, say, 40, 50%. Once I learned these skills and mastered them, now I'm batting much closer to like 90%. Right. And so that is the difference. So yeah, I was always, I think I was, and lots of people are innately kind of wired this way. Perhaps they have a higher EQ, perhaps it was modeled for them, whatever. But it's still really hard, as it is with any sport or any natural inclination, it's hard to perfect it without training. And that's kind of the difference. And that's what I hope to provide folks through the book is like, I'm going to give you the skills that therapists learn, because why should you have to get a PhD in clinical psychology to learn this stuff? It really should be in the water, right? This should be like in grade schools.
Well, exactly. And I think a lot of those skills, I mean, they may start with just certain words we can say. You know,
Yes.
even as simple as I hear you.
I hear you.
But let's get into those skills.
Yeah. So we kind of break them down into what we call these ones that convey more of like a lower level, just kind of that mindfulness. Remember I said validation is, it really includes mindfulness, understanding, and empathy. All right. And if you can do all that, that's a very powerful, very validating response. But if you're sitting across from your fiercest political opponent, it might be hard for you to empathize. And guess what? As a therapist, I am sitting across from folks who are saying and doing a lot of things that are problematic and concerning and dangerous that I don't understand and empathize with. And yet, in order to treat them, I have got to be able to validate some part of their experience. So at the bare minimum, when I really don't see eye to eye at all, I don't see any validity, I just focus on my first two mindfulness skills of attending and copying. I use nonverbals, I do the nodding, the eye contact. I try and figure out in my head, what is this person trying to say and how could I do a better job of saying it, right? Like almost as a debater would. And then I do a lot of copying, which sounds super weird and contrived, but it's just, you just put your hand on your face there. So it's literally mapping, it's mirroring what you do in terms of nonverbals and certain words that you say. Okay, now tell me, does that sound strange? Does that sound like, can you imagine doing that or does it feel like,
No, I mean, if I understand correctly, copying would be, in addition to this body language that you're talking about, that makes absolute sense. You might be saying something like, so what you're saying is this, or, which sounds a little contrived, and I bet you have a more natural way of doing it.
Oh my gosh, you're so good. Because most people, when they go for copying, they say, I hear you saying, or let me get this for it. And I'm actually talking about being much more subtle. So I would just pluck out an adjective or two that you used, confusing, surprising, discombobulated, like some specific words that you used, I would just repeat those. And what I'm doing in that moment is showing that I see what you see as important.
Mm.
Right. Very subtle.
Can I ask you, because you talked about the person, a patient of yours, you know, who would be saying, I've been abusing alcohol my whole life, but I can quit on my own. Okay, what sorts of adjectives are they going to be using in that case?
All right. So if someone says, I know you're going to think this is effed up. I know you're going to think this is effed up, but I can do it. And I'm like, effed up? All right, let me hear it. Okay. So I just literally parroted back what they said, but I'm speaking their language.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And that is the key here, because when you speak somebody's language, when you talk to them using the vocabulary that they use or the slang or whatever it may be, you're saying like, we speak the same language. We are similar in some way. So that's what I would be doing there. I'm just looking for like, what's the quality, the character that's being conveyed here? And I'm just going to map onto that. Now, there's something very sophisticated going on here when we copy, which is that we're activating mirror neurons. We are all hardwired to mimic and copy other people. We do it as babies. We copy the expressions of our caregivers. We do it as adults, but we're not aware of it. When we're attracted to someone, when we want to impress somebody, we start unknowingly mirroring them. It's fascinating. In so doing, we start to experience just a little taste of what they are experiencing, of what they're feeling. That is the function of mirror neurons. They help us empathize. And therefore, I have just moved myself a little bit closer to being able to understand and empathize with that person simply by virtue of using that one skill.
That's so great. Okay, we better quickly get to the other skills.
Yeah.
I love you have contextualize, which I don't understand, but then equalize. Anyone in your shoes would do the same.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
I've had so many experiences in my life where I've been like, I am not sure. Like, am I crazy here? Is this wrong? Am I wrong to do this? And to have someone else affirm, no, anybody in your shoes would feel that way. No, these demands are completely ridiculous. You are totally right to, I mean, it makes total sense that you would want to quit. I would too. There's just that, like, okay, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy. There's validity in what I'm thinking, feeling, or doing. That's what it signals. And that's a degree of understanding, right? It's someone saying, I see the logic. I understand. This is valid in a cognitive sense, in a logical sense.
You say sometimes words aren't enough, and there are actions like body language. There's an action like touch. Can you go into that a little bit more? How we really help validate someone?
Yeah, so that's at the very, very top. So if I can communicate empathy, if I actually do, if I see it, I get it, and I feel it, there are things I can do that would swiftly communicate all three of those components. And one of them is by taking action. Okay, so as a therapist, for instance, assuming I have good rapport, assuming this is a safe, dynamic I have with the other person. If they tell me something devastating that happened, and I break character and walk over and give them a hug, okay, and sit down with them, I'm actually taking action in some sense, right? I am intervening. On a larger scale, if someone is telling me that they are in a situation, they're, let's, I don't, I'm trying to think of, oh, shoot, something recent. Like my kid is struggling at school, let's say, and her teacher's being, she feels really unfair. And I can say all day, oh, that's horrible. I would feel bad if I were in your shoes too, if I felt like my teacher was out to get me and making me run laps around the school every time I made a mistake. Like that would be awful. I could do that. Or I could intervene on my child's behalf and say, step into the situation as an adult. Talk to the principal, talk to the teacher, and help resolve that situation. That sends a pretty clear signal that I'm there, I get it, and I care. Now you can easily see how that would go, could go south. Yeah, if kiddo doesn't want you to intervene. Right. And so with these empathy skills, like the higher you go up this like ladder of skills, the easier it is to screw up and get hurt when you fall. And so that's kind of some of the skill here is knowing how to do what and when to do what.
This is a great parenting book without it being a parenting book, but it's great for work settings. It's great for all kinds of settings. Before I let you go, I want to talk a bit about the word validation that's kind of gotten a bad rap without us really knowing why or really what it means, because there's that thing, oh, you shouldn't always be looking for external validation, but it's okay to want validation in the context that you and I have been talking about. Can you explore that a little bit more? What kind of external validation is bad, and what is what we're talking about?
So, thank you so much for bringing that up. Let me just set the record straight. You should seek external validation. Every single person deserves to feel accepted and seen in their relationships. It is difficult, in fact, impossible, I believe, to feel deeply loved if you don't feel like the other person actually sees you and accepts you. What do they love? Some facade? It doesn't make any sense. So, external validation is critical to our relationships. It is again different from praise. Excessively seeking praise, right, by filtering yourself on social media or constantly pushing and exceeding expectations, that can get you into trouble because in so doing, you will inevitably end up distorting yourself to impress. And that can be a house of cards. Like the more you kind of strive for that, the more your identity is built around that, the more fragile it is. But people who feel deeply accepted and seen in their relationships are among the healthiest, happiest people around. This is just a fundamental truth that has been buried beneath our misunderstanding of some of these terms.
So, if you are asking your partner for validation, how might we ask for it that isn't praise seeking, that it's just validation? How do we ask?
You know, I hope we get to a point at someday where we can just say, I appreciate the problem solving. I need validation. Most folks, I don't think, have that type of vocabulary, but it is totally valid to see that your partner is trying to help you, and to also say that I don't need that type of help. I need this. So at the bare minimum, you can say, I really appreciate you trying to problem solve here and troubleshoot. I think I just need to feel heard. I really just need to feel seen in this. I don't need any to change anything just yet. I just need to feel seen.
Yeah. But so often we don't know exactly what we want as well. So it takes a lot for me to say to my husband something like that. I don't know exactly. Yeah. Well, I say to him, I don't know exactly what I'm looking for here, but I need to tell you this.
Yeah, I think you can go a step further and say, I'm not looking necessarily for solutions, at least right, not yet. If you're getting hammered with, like I'm thinking of this conversation I had on the phone, or I had with my husband after getting off the phone with my oncologist. I'd been treated for breast cancer a couple of years back. Sorry, that's a big thing to drop at the end of this interview, but it's in the service of this story. And I just had this very frustrating conversation with this oncologist. And I'm like, oh, she's like, she forgot this thing. I'm supposed to be on this medication and I'm not, and I can't believe it. And I'm terrified. I'm in the middle of chemotherapy. And my husband jumps in with like, we need to get a different oncologist. And why don't we contact the hospital? And he's just like hammering me with this stuff. You know, he's concerned about me. And I just said, I can't do any of that right now. I just need validation.
Yeah.
I said, and if that's not your language, you could just say, I just need to someone else to tell me that this is insane. Yeah. That this is devastating. And I just need to be in this space. And I want you here with me. I don't need to intervene yet. I can't even go there. I'm flooded. My brain is like going in 1,000 different directions. It's not going to be constructive.
Yeah. That's a great illustration. Thank you for sharing that. I'm glad you're healthy.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry to have dropped that at the end of this interview. I'm fine. I'm much better. It's been well over a year.
Good. Well, the book is Validation, and it's the new approach to change that will transform how you love, lead, and live. My guest is Dr. Caroline Fleck. Caroline, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
The average American worker spends over 150 hours a year dealing with workplace conflict. And that's not counting the conflict they may be experiencing at home or in their other relationships. But conflict is part of life. Siblings fight, spouses fight, countries fight. And ironic as it may sound, we're all perhaps most connected by the common experience of disconnection. So what can we do to make resolving conflicts more manageable and less painful?
Well, today's guests have been working in the field for decades as mediators, coaches, and mentors to companies, pro sports teams, and individuals to help them understand what's underneath the conflicts we all experience and to learn how to identify the triggers and conflict styles that arise in our most stressful moments. Their new book, How to Get Along with Anyone, offers concrete steps for determining your own conflict style and fostering better communication and collaboration. Dr. John Elliott and Dr. James Gwynn, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're welcome.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, there are two major parts that your book is divided into: the type of conflicts that we experience and the typical ways that people respond to conflicts. Would you like to just give an outline of what the type of conflicts that people generally experience are for our listeners?
Absolutely. And you'll see, you know, we're both mediators. We both love conflict resolution. So we always defer to each other on podcasts and shows saying, hey, Dr. Elliott, would you like to take this? And no, absolutely. So Dr. Elliott, if you would like to run through the types of conflict.
Yeah. So in general, there are three types: process conflict, task conflict, and relational conflict. And the interesting thing is when someone gets in a disagreement, an argument, you know, people aren't clicking, or when they're not the best versions of themselves, they tend to think that conflict has to do with one person versus another, or you know, the problem is interpersonal. When in fact, most conflict is actually task or process, and it's not about the people. But that's the sort of first mistake: is we label it there's something wrong with the other person, something they said, something they did, and we sort of make it personal. When it's really about a task, i.e., well, what needs to be done and when, or a process, how things need to be done, and systems and policies and so forth.
Right. And so when I was reading over that part, my brother, he and his partner had a baby, and it made me think a lot about mother-in-laws or your mother after you have a baby, and how you've got this new situation, and to break it down, like the task trigger would be like the baby needs changing. All right, it just needs to get done. Doesn't matter. But then it's the process that seems to really get people up with parenting, right? It's like how you do it. How are you raising this child? And then there's the relationship. You have all these layers. How do you find people kind of, do they conflate all of these triggers sometimes, or does it tend to land in one most generally?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, one of the biggest things we really talk about when we say triggers is it going to evoke that emotional response to the point to where reason is going to lower? And so all of those things are frustrating, the relational conflict, the task, and the process. But typically for people, they're going to have one that just really, really gets them. So there may be some underlying, you know, relational things, you know, between the mother-in-law or between, you know, between the parents. But you know, really, it's a, hey, the process, like it's annoying. It's fine if you're using that tone of voice with me, if you're telling me I need to get this done, but if you're telling me how to change my own baby's diaper, now we're going to have an issue. And now we're going to get to that point. And so typically what we find is that, you know, while we experience all three types of conflict for each person, there's one that just really, really gets them. And I loved your example. We do these trainings, and we do these workshops and speaking and things in corporate settings, and hands down for both of us, it's when people come up to us after, it's never, oh, my boss or oh, my coworker. It's always, I have this mother-in-law or my roommate or my cousin did this. So that's a great example.
You know, as you were talking, it was making me think about how perhaps it's because we ultimately expect to have it in our work lives, in our professional lives, say, it's what's typically about is a lot of conflict. Whereas in our personal lives, we have more, there's more of an impetus, more motivation to resolve conflict. And maybe that's why at your workshops, I don't know, could you comment a little bit deeper on that? You know, why people come up and say, but it's my mother-in-law.
I just want to do a disclaimer saying my mother-in-law is amazing. And if she's listening to this, it's definitely not her.
No, none of ours. They are all really good people. Yes.
Yeah, it's very common for people to have different set of triggers at work and at home, and you hit the nail on the head because they may tend to be more focused on a task or a process at home, or sorry, at work. And at home, there's sort of an expectation that the relationship should always be, you know, smooth sailing and everyone should get along, because that's the whole point of relationships and your partnership with your spouse or your kids or so forth. You know, it's supposed to be about having a great relationship. That makes, you know, people set a bar that's a little too high, when in fact, you know, disagreements and not getting along and trying to figure out, you know, which one of you cares about tasks and which one of you cares about processes and which one that's less important than something else. All of that is the ingredients for better relationships. And learning that you have different styles and learning you have different preferences. If you're open to that, and you look at conflict as an opportunity to continue to get to know each other and continue to strengthen your understanding of each other, then conflict, you know, quote unquote conflict becomes an asset versus being quote unquote a chink in your armor to this perfectionistic ideal of everybody always getting along.
Right.
You know, some of the greatest relationship people have very vivid disagreements.
Yeah, true. It's so interesting how the both of you've worked in conflict resolution and mediation for a long time, from professional sports team all over all kinds of professions. And it's interesting to me, what you say is that it's really not about conflict resolution. It's about identifying who we are. And I'm wondering, you know, who we are, how we approach conflict, what kind of triggers we have. And so moving away from the actual concept of resolution and into more who we are as people. And I'm wondering, Jim, if you can talk about, you know, how many people out there ever really recognize what kind of person they are when it comes to conflict. Other than, it seems like people who know that they avoid conflict, they know they're avoiders.
Sure. No, absolutely. Great. Very, very well said. So really, you know, our background, so much of it, you know, whether it was in mediation and divorce mediation or getting called in after lawsuits are happening, it was always dealing with conflict on the back end. Once it had escalated to the point of a dispute, which, as you can see in the book, there's some pretty wild stories we have of some pretty big disputes, but dealing with it on the back end, trying to resolve the issue, not the person. And you know, we really found one, that's a heck of a lot harder to do, resolve the conflict once it's gotten to that point. And maybe we can avoid it or pull the Barney Fife and nip it in the bud. But secondly, you know, can we, you know, really get to know the person and really dive into that versus the issue. And so that's really was kind of our goal of creating these trainings and, you know, which led to the book was, okay, are there some conflicts that we can either resolve altogether before they really escalate, or are there some that we can really get on the front end? And so much about the style, I mean, there's a ton of really good tools out there that can tell you who you are, and absolutely it's important to know what triggers you and what your style is, but so much about, you know, what we focus on is how to assess what somebody else's style is. So knowing, okay, because John has this profile, here's some techniques and things that are going to work well with him. Here's some tools for the tool belt that are going to work, versus if I go use this separate style or these techniques, I'm just going to make things worse.
Right. And we probably don't have enough time to go into all of it, but you do outline the 5 go-to conflict personality styles. We have the avoider, the competitor, the analyzer, the collaborator, and the accommodator. And all those types were so interesting. And I found myself wondering, is there a best type? Is there an ideal type of conflict approacher that we should all aspire to, or does each have its own strengths and weaknesses? How about you, Dr. Elliott?
Yeah, you hit it, right? Each one has its own strengths and weaknesses. There's not one profile that makes someone a good leader or makes someone a good spouse or makes someone a good salesperson. The real key, right? The real key, if you're saying, you know, I want to be better in my relationships at work and at home. I want to have more, you know, because a lot of this comes from, you know, team chemistry and locker room and so forth. And people don't realize in that situation, those elite athletes, they have the same issues with each other that we do at home at breakfast. But if we're thinking about team chemistry and aspiring to that, the secret is not in one profile. The secret is recognizing that people have different styles. When there's a disagreement or when they're overtired, that they have a habit that they go to. And the real goldmine is understanding what's your habit and the people you care about having great team chemistry with, what's their habit? What's their style? Because if you know their style and your style, you know how to work toward their strengths and steer away from their weaknesses, and the same thing for yourself.
Yeah, you have a lot of great sports metaphors in the book that are very helpful, because really life is about teamwork in so many ways. It's about kind of managing each other, managing our roles. I noticed there's a strong emphasis on emotional regulation. So you want to find yourself in this calm or regulated place before you jump in and are reactive, maybe even overreactive to the thing. But it's a common stereotype that women are more emotional than men. Do you find that women and men tend to respond to and approach conflict resolution very differently?
Well, one of the keys, and I'll let Jimmy jump in here, one of the keys is recognizing emotion is the lifeblood of being creative, interesting, fascinating, wonderful people. I mean, it's a real asset that humans have emotion. And so when we talk about emotional regulation, we're not talking about keep emotion out of the equation. It's more recognizing what are the emotions that fuel great relationships and how to use those, and when are the emotions that are getting in the way, and what causes the ones that get in the way, you know, to address those causes. And so if we think of trying to be unemotional, be Dr. Spock, we're going down the wrong path, right?
No, yeah, absolutely. And just to echo that, I think, yeah, that's been one of the most fascinating things we've, you know, found from writing the book and all of our research is, you know, whether it's going to work with a company, a school district, a church, whatever it is, whether it's working with men or with women or younger or older, you know, so much of it really is about the profile, and it really is about the triggers that a competitor versus an accommodator is not going to end well if they're both triggered, regardless of their backgrounds or where they came from. And just to, you know, echo what Doc said, you know, it's not about removing the emotion. It's about regulating the emotion.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation about, well, it's about How to Get Along with Anyone. That's the name of the book by our guests, John Elliott and Jim Gwynn. And it's the playbook for predicting and preventing conflict at work and at home. And Jim, I'm wondering, you know, you both get maybe a good percentage of your bread and butter from consulting with professional sports teams. And along what you were just talking about, along with the sports metaphors that Mary Beth brought up, what is different about people in professional sports, in the whole professional sports arena, from, you know, from competitors to those who manage and all that? How are they, what makes them different than the rest of us or similar?
Sure. And I'll be brief to let Doc jump in because he's got some great stories to share as well. But I think the biggest overarching thing is, you know, people look at it and they think, okay, well, the most, you know, famous, you know, athletes or coaches, obviously they're all competitors. Well, absolutely they are, you know, and they learn to do that. It may not be their default style. They've learned to do it. But when you really watch and really dig in, you see that how they master the other styles as well. They've learned to, the most successful coaches, the most successful athletes, they've learned to be all of them, mainly because they know what motivates other people. So for example, a quarterback may be competitive, but they know I can't deal with this receiver the same way I'm going to deal with this offensive lineman. I need to have a different approach based off that. So I know, Doc, you're the expert on this, but I think that's really my biggest overarching thing.
The little secret is that the fundamental difference between, you know, elite athletes and ourselves is that their lives are broadcast and under a microscope, right? We see them handling conflict, you know, on the TV and the Super Bowl and so forth, where a lot of us, the world isn't watching our conflict moments. And as Jim pointed out, the other thing is they spend a lot more time training on these things, where a lot of us, you know, aren't aware that we have different styles and that some styles, you know, work well together and that we need to be, we instead of thinking about conflict as a big, you know, hairy problem, we think of it in terms of styles and understanding each other and communication. The best athletes, you know, spend a lot of time on that and figure it out. And it's one of the reasons why some make it and some don't. And that's the lesson we take from them, is aspiring to be able to adapt and have different styles and different situations and spend some time practicing.
That's great. Okay, so Dr. Elliott, is avoiding conflict counterproductive or productive? I think I know the answer, but I'd love for you to explore it a bit.
Yeah, a lot of times it's counterproductive. There are situations where tabling a conflict and getting it back to it later, or letting it dissipate on its own, there's some situation where that's advisable. And if you happen to have an avoider style, you're really good at doing that. And so we hope that you're in a leadership position for that particular type of situation. But a lot of other situations, the roots of the conflict, in other words, people are getting, you know, they're getting emotional, and their differences are becoming, you know, very transparent. And the reason that's happening is because people really care deeply about something. And if you don't care too much, you're not going to bother, you know, getting in a disagreement with someone, because it doesn't really matter. And so when we see that emotions are heating up, and we see that people, their differences are causing them to clash, that's an illustration that something really important between the two people, with what they're trying to accomplish, with their relationship, it's an illustration. Hey, there's something really meaningful here. And if we stop and take the time to understand, you know, what's behind it, what's the underlying interest, and, you know, what is it that people really care about, and why are they getting triggered, then that's really valuable information to learn about yourself and somebody else in the relationship that then you can build on to be great teammates. And so we don't want to, and if we find a way to dismiss it or ignore it, we're losing an incredible opportunity.
Absolutely. And just to echo my mentor, to use the country expression, would say, don't pick a tomato when it's green or when it's brown. You got to pick it when it's ripe, but you got to pick it at the right time. So sometimes there's, you know, all conflict can be resolved. Not all conflict should be resolved at that time. So I think that's a big piece.
Right, right. Well, a fascinating process kept happening as I was reading your various examples. I would immediately think of someone or some situation in which I felt a conflict, and I'd find my annoyance or even anger growing more as I read through how I should approach the conflict to help them de-escalate and be less rigid, how I need to help them feel affirmed and them feel validated. And I was just like, why should I be doing all this work to make somebody else feel better? And then I was like, oh no, wait a minute. Am I the problem? So how can we better recognize where we might be actually the trigger for others?
Sure. So
The key in there is recognizing that, you know, once you have this knowledge and once you're aware of styles, how to assess them, how they impact, then, you know, you have the burden of leadership where people say, you know, if I have the ability to handle a difficult situation and I have the knowledge and resources to do so, then unfortunately it's on me to take care of my team. And so part of that is recognize, you know, part of the question is, you know, hey, why is it on me to do this? Well, it's on you to do this because you have the skills and the talent and the knowledge to be able to steer things in a really productive direction that will benefit both of you. So that's one part of the equation. And then also recognizing that in doing so and in communicating what your style is and what you need, part of that equation is communicating some of those things to the person and helping them help you in the famous Cuba Gooding Jr. line.
Absolutely. And a lot of it depends on your motivation too, because I know the book is How to Get Along with Anyone, but you may not want to. You may not like that person, and you may not really want to get along with that person. So if your motivation really is, and it could be, it's just, hey, I want to resolve the conflict, doesn't escalate, so I don't have to keep dealing with this person, keep dealing with this conflict. So my wife, beautiful, brilliant, way smarter than me, night shift ER nurse, and she would always call them frequent flyers, people that would keep coming to the ER over and over and over and over, using it as their primary care doctor because they're really looking for other things. And so another part of our motivation could be truly, if we don't resolve this conflict, if we don't resolve the true underlying interests, as Doc said, we're just going to keep dealing with this over and over with these superficial issues.
So true. And there's another great quote that you had in the book of Remember the Titans, that you don't have to like each other, but you will respect each other. And it feels like respect is at the heart of a lot of this conflict resolution, that to find and be willing to understand and approach situations in a way that allows everybody to come to the table. How much is respect a part of it, in your opinions?
Huge.
It's huge. And you hit on a reason, you know, why this book, why now? We see in a lot of, you know, circles, arenas, and workplaces around the world right now, it's just a noticeable lower level of respect for one another and willingness to listen to one another, because listening doesn't mean agreeing. But because that's going on, we really wanted to try and make this piece about, you know, listening to one another, understanding one another, finding ways to collaborate, even if you don't like one another, because as you said, you know, respect is at the heart of this.
Yeah. If people started respecting each other more, we'd be out of business, and that would be fine with us. Just a lot less conflict.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You both say that emotion and reason don't really coexist harmoniously, or if we're feeling a lot of emotion, you know, our ability to reason is compromised. And I just want to go to that base feeling that I think a lot of people get when they're experiencing conflict. The first feeling you get is that feeling in your gut and maybe an elevated heart rate. And when I get that, boy, I know I'm not going to be able to respond. So obviously, Jim, this is a trigger for me, right? It's a trigger, the feeling in the gut, the elevated heart rate, this is triggering my emotion. So can you just, for our listeners, you know, talk about where to go from there?
Sure, absolutely. And I think you summed it. I think you summed it up well. The examples we use is, you know, how you act when you're in love, when you're scared, when you're, you know, frustrated, the decisions you make. And so one of the techniques that we really encourage, and can blame us if it doesn't work, but as email draft technique. So just if you're feeling that feeling in your gut and you're bouncing that email, just put it in the draft, go do some form of exercise. It could be walking around. It could be anything, going outside, come back 30 minutes later and reread and see what you think. And we find that oftentimes we change that email a little bit. And so we may not always have 30 minutes for the face-to-face conversation without looking strange and staring off into space. But taking that same concept in a smaller time frame to pause and to really think through when you have that feeling, do I really need to respond right now?
Yeah, That's good. John, I'm wondering if we don't know what type of conflict personality style we have, as I said before, we probably know if we're avoiders, but I look through the other four, the competitor, the analyzer, the collaborator, the accommodator. If we can't figure it out, does that mean that, oh, maybe it's just because we're an avoider? I mean, how do we look at ourselves and do that self-test? Buy your book, I think, probably.
Much appreciated.
Well, yeah, obviously the easy answer is come on over to theconflictdocs.com. We have an assessment you can take that'll give you a scouting report and your strengths and weaknesses and so forth. And so, but we provide that because sometimes it's not simple and obvious. And because you might be a competitor at work and you might be an accommodator at home, and what you're the sort of examples you're thinking through your head, it's not intuitive at first. And if you haven't thought about it a lot, and this is your first sort of foray into, oh, conflict has different types and people have different styles. It's not just, you know, that people dislike each other. And when the first time you sort of think through that, it may not be obvious. And so it's not that you don't know or that you happen to have a particular weakness. It's just you need to spend some time doing the reflection. And that's really invaluable reflection time. And we say it's what's valuable for corporate retreats and trainings and so forth and to go grab lunch with a teammate and use this as a tool to understand each other. That's really valuable time. And it may take you a while to really drill down on what your styles are and triggers and so forth. But the time it takes you to do that is really valuable in what you learn about yourself and others.
I'm glad you mentioned that there is a test engine on your site, theconflictdocs.com. And again, we're speaking with Dr. James Gwynn and Dr. John Elliott about their new book, How to Get Along with Anyone. Is there any element of this that applies to internal conflicts?
That's a fantastic question, because we find ourselves in situations where we have difficulty making a decision or we're torn between two things. So if you really look at the issue that's going on, you know, let's say that you're trying to buy a new car, but you're frustrated and the salesperson is triggering you and you don't know if it's worth the money and your spouse, you know, has a different opinion on the utility of cars. You know, your spouse may, you know, like cars for the recreation and the appearance and so forth, and you're, you know, truly pragmatic about it. And so you start, you know, basically negotiating with and against yourself. And it's a it's a great signal to take a 30-second timeout, take a step back and say, okay, the two things in my brain that are getting in the way, you know, which one of those things is trying to be an avoider, which one's trying to be an analyzer and why? And what's sort of meaningful for me versus where am I adopting, you know, somebody else's perspective rather than being true to myself?
Right. Yeah, like parts therapy, like what part of me is doing this and what part of me is coming from another part, right? Well, I wish we had so much more time to speak with you both today. This is so interesting. The book, again, is called How to Get Along with Anyone, and the authors are Dr. John Elliott and Dr. Jim Gwynn. We've been so happy to speak with you on The Mountain Life. Thank you for all your tips, and I highly recommend this book. It is interesting, and I argued with it a lot as I was reading, which tells me that it's sparking something in me that I need to look at closely. And so I appreciate you being part of the program. Thanks for being on The Mountain Life.
Thanks, guys.
Pleasure's all ours. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us and all the amazing work y'all do.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.